Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. This lecture is about different theories of international relations. As I've said, you'll see a lot of game theoretic models in future lectures, which are meant to help us understand patterns of cooperation and conflict better. We're still not quite ready to do that, but we're getting close. In the previous lecture, I told you how to analyze game theoretic models. In this one, I'm trying to give you a better sense of what's going to go in them. That is, all the models you'll see in future lectures embody the core assumptions of one or another of the theories we're about to discuss. Which theory will vary from lecture to lecture, because no one theory is right. Like models, the question we should ask of theories isn't whether they are true or not, but whether they are useful. And that's going to depend on what we're trying to do with them. I should note at this point, as it says on the first slide, that I'm only going to introduce you to explanatory theories of IR. I contrast those with critical theories, which are less interested in helping us understand patterns of cooperation and conflict than in critiquing the work of other IR scholars, either because the proponents of these theories don't believe it's possible to gain any sort of objective understanding of the world, or because they're more interested in changing it than understanding it, and feel that bringing the biases of other scholars to their attention is one important way of doing that. I do believe it's possible to understand the world better, and my goal with this module is to help you do so. Accordingly, my focus in this lecture will be on theories that share that goal. Turn now to the second, and only other, slide. As I say there, we can differentiate explanatory theories of IR by the answers they give to three questions. Who are the dominant actors in international relations? What do they want? And what constraints do they face in pursuing their goals? The first entry in the table is neorealism. As the name suggests, that's a newer version of what we now call classical realism. Aside from the fact that we wouldn't have neorealism if not for classical realism, though, the latter doesn't have much influence on contemporary scholarship, so I'm not going to talk too much about it in the future. But if you're curious, the primary difference between it and neorealism is that classical realists believed states sought power for its own sake, rather than as a means to an end, because they thought that it was human nature to do so. For that reason, classical realism is also sometimes referred to as human nature realism. Neorealists, on the other hand, argue that the structure of the international system, namely the absence of a central authority that can compel states to follow the rules, the way capable, well-functioning governments foster rule of law domestically, forces states to pursue power in order to survive. And survival is assumed to be their primary goal. Note, I've written security in the table because survival is not the only important goal, and it falls under the broader umbrella of security. Both classical and neorealists, however, argue that domestic politics is largely irrelevant, in the sense that it does little to shape the behavior of states on the world stage. They're similarly skeptical about the impact of international institutions and norms. The only real constraints they see on state behavior are material. In other words, states do what they feel they must to protect themselves given their capabilities, which matter a lot, as we'll discuss later. A famous phrase here, taken from Thucydides, who some regard as the first scholar of international relations, is, "The strong do what they will, while the weak suffer what they must." This is not a happy view of international relations, but too many students, and scholars for that matter, make the mistake of dismissing it for that reason. Remember, we're talking about explanatory theories, not, say, foreign policy orientations. I admit they can be confusing, because some policymakers use the term realist or refer to realpolitik to describe their views of how governments should behave. And for that reason, students who approve of a might makes right mentality often embrace realism as explanatory theory, while students who wish to live in a more cooperative, orderly world where states behave like responsible members of a global community reject it. Both of those are mistakes. As I've said previously, I don't much care how you think the world should work. We're here to talk about how it does work. And while it's certainly not true that domestic politics plays literally no role in shaping behavior on the world stage, and I'm going to do my best to convince you later that international institutions have an important impact on how states behave, I'm also going to make the case that a lot of the patterns we'd expect to observe if the world was as stark as neorealism envisions are in fact evident in the historical record. And I don't just mean the 19th century, when states were far more open about practicing power politics. In other words, I'm not going to try to convince you that the assumptions of neorealism are true. The point is that they don't need to be. We do not live in the world neorealism describes. I'm comfortable saying that. But that obvious truth appears to matter a lot less than you might think, because the world we do live in exhibits many of the same patterns of behavior we expect from the one neorealism describes. On the flip side, if you call yourself a realist because you endorse realpolitik as an approach to foreign policy, and you think you can carry that label over to the realm of explanatory theories of IR, you've made a different sort of mistake, but a mistake nonetheless. Realism as an explanatory theory of international relations, as I've said, assumes that domestic politics doesn't matter because states are going to do what they need to do no matter who's in charge. So if you think it matters whether the United States has a Republican or Democratic president, or believe that British foreign policy under Jeremy Corbyn would differ from what it has been under David Cameron, you have rejected a core assumption of realism as an explanatory theory of international relations, be it of the classical or neo variety. And while I think people tend to overestimate the difference individual leaders make, at least in the case of major powers like the US and the UK, I don't think anyone would go so far as to say that elections in these countries have no implications for foreign policy. Which is fine. There's no reason you should believe that assumption, unless you're foolish enough to view simplified theories that are only meant to grant partial insights into a complex world as extensions of your identity, as though picking the right one might somehow prove that you are a smarter, better person. That's not how this works. Okay, let's move on to neoliberalism. You'll note that I am going to discuss both the newer and more classical versions of liberalism, so you might be wondering why I'm going out of order. The reason is that neoliberalism, as an explanatory theory of international relations, has more in common with neorealism. The term neoliberalism, by the way, has taken on a different meaning in public discourse. I'm not referring here to the idea that everyone is better off if governments cut taxes and deregulate industries. I'm talking about an explanatory theory of international relations, one that was, admittedly, influenced by some of the same writers as neoliberals in that other sense. Neoliberalism, as an explanatory theory of international relations, was basically developed as an attempt to prove to neorealists that even if they were fundamentally right about states and security being the actors and goals that matter most, their conclusions still wouldn't follow. Note that neoliberalism answers two of the three questions the same way as neorealism. They agree that states are the dominant actors, implying that domestic politics isn't too important, and that their driving interest is security. I glossed over this above, but I should say a little more about what I mean by that. Both neorealism and neoliberalism assume that states seek first and foremost to survive, but also to preserve their territorial integrity and their policy autonomy. That is, it's not enough to simply avoid being wiped off the face of the map. States also want to keep their borders as they are, or if anything, expand them, and wish to avoid having some foreign power dictate any aspect of their foreign or domestic policy to them. The big difference is that neoliberals argue that neorealists are too quick to reject the importance of international institutions. And to preview arguments I'll make later on, just a little bit, I think it's clear that neoliberals are right about that. It's very hard to defend the claim that international institutions have absolutely no impact on how states behave, though that hasn't kept some from trying. But again, it's a mistake to waste one's time arguing about whether any given assumption is true. The question is how useful it is to acknowledge that the world is more complicated. How much do international institutions matter? If you've been paying attention so far, it won't surprise you to hear that my answer is, it depends. In other words, I think it's just as much a mistake to declare neoliberalism superior to neorealism as it is to call yourself a realist in the IR theory sense of the word, simply because you think leaders should do whatever they feel is in the national interest without regard for right or wrong international law or public opinion. For some sorts of questions, we can ignore international institutions and still arrive at useful answers. For others, we can't. And that's why some of the models you'll see me present moving forward will in fact ignore international institutions, while others will not. That brings us to classical liberalism. As you can see from the table, this earlier version of liberalism tells us to focus on individuals rather than treating states as unitary actors. Which individuals? Well, that too depends. There are several different versions of liberalism. Commercial liberalism tends to focus on consumers and producers, or the different interests of labor and capital. That version will inform some of what I have to say about patterns of cooperation, given that I'll mostly focus on economic cooperation. Republican liberalism focuses on citizens, leaders, and the rules governing their interaction. This leaves open the possibility that the type of government a state has influences the conduct of its foreign policy. We'll talk a lot more about that later on when we get to conflict. It's because the different versions of classical liberalism focus on different actors that I've simply written various for the goals these actors are assumed to pursue and the constraints they face. Commercial liberalism assumes that what people desire most is prosperity, and views the skills and resources people possess currently as a key determinant of whether they'll achieve it. Naturally, it also focuses a lot on government policy. Republican liberalism assumes that citizens have a variety of goals, including peace and prosperity, but also some regard for the national interests and a host of other things, while assuming that leaders, who are usually the real focus, are driven first and foremost by political ambition, as in the desire to remain in power. What they need to do that, depends in large part on domestic political institutions. Finally, we come to constructivism. This is not always included as an explanatory theory. Some self-identified constructivists are more interested in making their fellow scholars aware of their biases than they are in telling anyone anything new about how the world works. And if that's all there was to constructivism, I wouldn't have included it in the table, and this lecture would now be over. However, while constructivist scholars don't always focus on exploring the implications of this, their work clearly does suggest a distinct set of answers to the three questions I posed above, and can thus inform attempts to uncover and explain patterns of cooperation and conflict. Some versions of constructivism share realism's focus on the state as a unitary actor, while others focus on individuals the way classical liberalism does. What they all have in common, though, is the belief that actors care about what others think of them, and also about their ability to look themselves in the mirror at the end of the day. That is, constructivists assume that states, individuals, and groups are motivated in large part by a desire for respect and a need for self-respect. That assumption requires us to focus on norms, values, and identity to understand behavior, and may help us understand why no state has attacked another with nuclear weapons since 1945, why human rights practices are slowly and modestly improving, even in authoritarian regimes, as well as patterns of political violence involving non-state actors, i.e. terrorism and insurgency, which we'll discuss later on.